John, are you ready?
Sure.
Yep.
All right, we're on.
Go on.
I'd like to call to order the December 14th meeting of the Isle of Palms Planning Commission and acknowledge that the press and the public were duly notified in accordance with state law. First item on our agenda is the approval of our minutes from our meeting of October 9th.
November 9th, right?
Excuse me, November 9th. Any comments?
I would make a motion to approve as submitted.
Second.
Motion and second to approve as submitted. Any comments? And all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. On to old business. But before that, when do we want to hear from, well, after he gets hooked up, I guess.
Yeah, so we sure. Will, let's just talk about the, is it?
We're all staring at you.
Yeah.
Dr. Tucker.
What's he doing?
Is it, so far as you're concerned, if we were to carry on with our regular business, come back to your comments, it's not going to?
No, that's
okay.
Fine. I've got an hour or so here, so if we can
do okay.
This work. Yeah. And I'll just say, as an absolute backup, I could come here next month with a screen. And I brought a projector, but I don't see a screen, so.
Yeah.
But
okay.
I mean, this worked completely fine last night. It normally does. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, let's just.
Well, should we go to the short term rental?
You want to do that?
That one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Start with that.
Okay.
I guess we need a motion to
no.
Rearrange the agenda. No, thank you. I like it.
So, under old business, update on short-term rental recommendations on implementing a cap. Seems like we may have had a few updates along the way. Go ahead. Are these on? I don't know.
Maybe the mics aren't on. Not
actually, I'm not.
This it still picks it up when you
okay.
Guys talk.
So the as I think you all are aware, City Council received your recommendations on caps and zones. They've received, they've had three different listening sessions. I think generally the response from the public at those listening sessions was to not implement caps, but rather better enforce the ordinances that are already in place. That's definitely a generalization on my part, but that was my takeaway. That, and there were certainly people that were in favor of caps at those listening sessions, but that was the general kind of takeaway. Council then started talking about the recommendations and the comments at the public listening sessions, and so the concern was raised that there are, over the last several months, there has been a sharp increase in the number of licenses issued. I said kind of off the cuff probably several times that I thought that spike was really related to residents getting a license to protect themselves. The more we kind of dug, that was questioned, led us to kind of dig into it a little bit more. And I will say that there were a number of residents that did do that. But out of the couple of hundred, there was probably half of them that had previously been rentals and were getting a license. So not what I would call a new rental, but not somebody just protecting themselves. And then there was a number of truly new rentals. So I would say to characterize that spike as just owners protecting themselves was probably an inaccurate statement. So that led to council to directed staff to prepare and present a moratorium on short-term rentals. We borrowed pretty heavily from what Folly Beach has just done and what they are currently working under, and we brought that back to the City Council, and City Council ultimately decided to not enact a moratorium, but I would say that they did commit to very quickly after the new year buckle down and come up with some discussion and votes on policies that would control short-term rentals. Don't know what that will be, and again, they really haven't, that group has not really discussed in any great detail what their ideas may be to address short-term rentals. So that's kind of where we are. It's been a, you know, there's been a lot of kind of packed houses here with residents. I would say that whatever they come up with will, I'm guessing, will include a change in the zoning code. So you will be brought back into that fold at some point, I would suspect, depending on what council decides. So that's all I really have. No decisions to be made or anything like that, but I did want to just keep you in the loop because I do think that after council has their deliberations, something will come back to this group. Any questions about that?
Is it worthwhile to work with them from our perspective and everything that we have done to help, not so much to help them along the way, but an interchange of information? And
yeah, they have, I think if we were to do that, it would be at their request.
Uh-huh.
You know, we would just see if that's something that they needed or asked of us. I do, you know, I'm hearing discussions about potentially having a cap that is triggered by your tax rate.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, you know, we don't have really current data on our current short-term rental properties, how they, what percent of them are 6%, 1%, or 4%, because those numbers are constantly in flux. So I did just happen to get the county's assessed data today. We did that when we, and Dave and Stephen were pretty heavily involved with merging the county's data with our business license data, but of course, you do that work, and then 6 months goes by, and it's a completely different set of numbers and properties, so it just changes overnight, literally. So I could see that if that's a route where it's another kind of data mining exercise, that I think that they probably will request. But there will be some kind of back and forth. I mean, I feel sure. Any route they go will take some back and forth between the two groups.
So, Douglas, you brought up a point that was kind of subtly buried in our initial recommendation. We also mentioned it when we had a joint session with the council here, and you've hit on it a couple of times now, which is getting better data and maintaining better data. You know, what we did last year, you know, was a pretty cobbled together effort. It took a lot of hours of volunteer time, unfortunately some out time, the company volunteered some time to help us, but it's not really sustainable to keep doing that. And I'm just wondering, has the city administrative staff looked at other ways, other databases? I presented some information to you on ArcGIS, our info databases, a way of continually updating this information and keeping it current so we don't keep getting back into this, gee, we're 6 months out of date, or we have 200 licenses but we really don't know what the breakdown is, or it just seems like this is going to be a forever thing. This is it's a $100 million business on this island, and we don't really manage the data. You know, like I said, what we did was very cobbled together, and it was a snapshot in time. And I think we need to get better at looking forward and having an ongoing, active database. Has anything happened there?
There's not a lot of difference between the way it was when you all did it. I can tell you that our software, you know, we've had to kind of get to a point where we are generating, because it's now asked for every few days, kind of what's the current number. So we are much more proficient at just generating the current number of licenses. When it comes to analyzing the pool, you know, we're really not. And just, you know, I think a couple of months ago we were kind of thinking about geographical areas, and Matt, we are in a position where Matt has his arms around GIS software. And I think that was the way that we assumed we would be going. This new line of thought is to not use geographical areas at all and instead go with the county's data. County, as you will recall, is very reluctant to anybody kind of tying into their back end. So while their data is changing daily, they're not going to want to let us kind of be attached. So every so I think it all depends on what the final desire is. I mean, what do we want to be tied to the county's data? Do we want to be tied to geography? So I don't know. I think we'd be premature in developing a program of management before we know what aspect of it we are managing, because each one's going to be different. So I think if council changes a policy, which I think they probably will, there's going to be part of that exercise is going to be the staff analyzing whatever the change is to best determine what the needs are in terms of database management.
Even if you have, what the county has is current, is lagging by the dysfunction of another county office with the recording of deeds and that data going in. So we're, I think, still like 6 months backlog on some of that for even the county's data on a lot of the sales and transfers that have happened.
Right.
So we're not getting
ownership
good information in.
Ownership is kind of one database, tax rates another database, current, the web crawling aspect of who's out there advertising is still a third service, and then here locally, you know, the clerks entering the rental licenses into the system is a fourth service. So there is definitely a lot of pieces, basically databases, that are not connected. And I feel sure that whatever we do, if a policy change is made, we would want to connect those databases. But it's a very long-winded way of saying, until we know what we're trying to do, I think we'd be premature and
create.
Well, part of that answer, I agree with some of your answer that is a yes and no, but you know, establishing a true GIS database, starting with a piece of parcel, you can attach all the different databases at any time whenever they're updated. So you have to get to the concept of saying, is that what we're trying to accomplish? No matter where the database comes from, are we really going to establish a system that starts at that? I click on a piece of property and I know everything about it. No matter how frequently those databases, that's what GIS does. It takes all these independent databases and brings them together no matter when they're updated. I just think we can be headed down that path no matter what the outcome is, or no matter how we decide we're going to regulate. And that's what we started to do with the one we cobbled together. And I think I think we should be looking at those type of systems. That's really what a true GIS database does.
Yeah, I mean, there will be, and I'll just be honest, from my perspective, kind of every 3-4 years, this discussion comes up, and each time there's probably 3 or 4 different people, so 3 individuals will say, I would love to have, you know, all this data at my fingertips, or they'll ask for a report, a piece of paper will get generated, and whoever looks at it says, well, that's interesting, and then it just sits there. Mm-hmm. So it would be if that's what happens, I don't know that, and if we're just going to continue to manage them how they've been, I don't think there'd be a real need to put the resources into that management.
I guess part of that answer then is if that's the way we're going to continue to manage 1,500 licenses and a $100 million business, then you're right. There's no need to change what we're doing. I'm just questioning maybe there is a need to change what we're doing.
Yeah. Certainly if my position, if the policy were to change, I feel sure that we'll have to do something. All right.
all systems go? Maybe.
No, there was no audio for the first 20 minutes. If you want to start over, that would be
great. It was uneventful.
Okay, what's that?
We have a good meeting for 20 minutes.
Okay.
Do I need this? Or?
Yes.
Does the mic need new batteries?
No, it does, yeah.
Got piles.
I guess I got
what do we got in there? I don't know. Those triple double.
Oh, there's chicken. 13. Wait.
Whoa.
No, never mind. You guys are pretty good. You guys are old news.
He's got it.
You got it there?
I'm Myron Tucker, and I'm here just to kind of represent the Morgan Creek Harbor Association. I've given this talk to a couple other groups, including the Wild Dunes Community Association, and a lot of people think that I'm here to talk about the marina per se, and I'm really not. I'm here to talk about all of the back island, all the marsh area, and how all this is interconnected. Let's see if I can. I'll just say next. So, you know, all these areas are interdependent, and you know, we can look at the marina here, but what I want to talk to you about is everything that's on the right side of the screen. Next. So this is sort of a Google Earth look at this end of the island. Next. If you stand on that bridge right there, everybody knows the bridge to Waterway Island, and if you look towards the marsh side, next. It's just a beautiful estuary, and those of you who have been up there kind of appreciate how really cool it is, I swear.
So, let me try one other thing.
Oh, well, next. So, as you stand on the bridge, all day long, you just see activity like this. Kayaks, next. We'll just keep going through this pretty quick. Everybody loads up, and a lot of these people, in fact, most of these people are not Wild Dunes people. They're Isle of Palms people or people that are visiting here. Next. Everybody loads up there at the boat ramp and heads up the creek. And if you stand in the marina at any time of the day, you'll just see 5, 10, 15 people cruising up there. Next. So everybody heads up under the bridge and goes through this amazing estuary. Next. And I'm standing on my dock, and just at night I see things like this. That's a group that's taken off at sunset. There's about 8 or 10 people. Next. I was actually out on my paddleboard about 3 weeks ago, and there was a lot of dolphin activity around, so I took an old iPhone, and this, I thought might happen, I ran into a dolphin. He actually ran into me, bumped into my paddleboard. It was pretty exciting. But just the area back there is so amazing. Next. And this is from Isle of Palms and from Wild Dunes websites. Hey, everybody advertises that this is a really cool part of our island. We all talk about the front beach and all, but back here it's also really important and cool. Next. A lot of boating activity back here that's diminished a little bit over the past 5 or 6 years because of the loss of depth, which I'll talk about in a minute. Next. So I'm not really talking about the marina, except that this is a plug that keeps water from flowing in and out of all of the other areas. Next. So if you look north of, kind of northeast of that, you can see, next, you just see all, oops, I went backwards. One more, next. So you can see all these in and out zigzag areas where you literally can get kayaks, paddle boards, and used to be able to get boats through most of that area, but it's become shallower and shallower over time. Next. So everybody knows what the Continental Divide is, right? I grew up in Colorado, so I literally walked a couple hundred miles of that at some point in my life. But next, obviously all the water that goes to the east of the Continental Divide ends up in the Gulf, and all the water that goes to the west, left, next, ends up in the Pacific. Next. So as it turns out, if you look at our estuary, we basically have a Continental Divide as well. And if you know where the, on Seagrass Land, there's a house that looks kind of like an Italian villa, and it's got like a dock that's about a mile long, or it goes out. Next. And that ends up right there. And if you're on a paddleboard at dead slack tide, or high tide, dead slack tide, if there was no wind, if you're 100 yards north of that, next, keep going, next, 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 next. So if you're 100 yards north of that line, you're going to drift out into Deweese Inlet. Next. But if you're on the other side of that line, next, all that water, next, keep going, next, 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 this area right here, next, all that, next, all that heads out the marina. So whatever happens from that red line to the left is dependent on how good the water flow is through the marina. Next. So next. So that's kind of the area that we outlined. We're starting at that Continental Divide going to the southwest. Next. And that's the stop plug. When the marina gets plugged up, the rest of that gets plugged up. Next. So there's an area next, just a little bit north of the bridge, that last time we dredged, and we dredged to about 10 feet, that area there was about, at low tide, about 4.5 to 5 feet at least, sometimes a little bit better. Next. Now, it's a little bit hard to see on this TV, but at low tide, if I jump off a paddleboard, I'd probably sprain my ankle. It's literally 6 inches underwater. So we've gone from 6 feet of depth to 6 inches of depth. Next. So the whole thing is to try to get the flow coming in and out of the marina. Next. So we want to keep this area, next, and the area just a little bit further north, next. One more time, next. So there's some areas Jeff used to live on Seagrass Lane, and he could tell you, hit it three times, next, next, next. There's three areas there that people used to be able to have boats there that at low tide you can't get through. In fact, if you have a paddleboard, I have a paddleboard, Hopi-Cat paddleboard that or kayak that has paddles underneath, and they're only about a foot and a half long, but I can't use them in that area. Next. And it's just getting worse over time. Next. So dredging serves two purposes. Next. It obviously keeps the marina functional and navigable. That's important to boaters, but more important, it increases the flow of water in and out of the marsh. So even if you had no interest in boats or boating or whatever, but if you have any interest in what happens, whether it's fishing, paddleboarding, kayaking, whatever. So dredging, we have to do it every 7 to 10 years. Next. Last done in 2013. Next. We did the depth to 10 feet, but right now we have some areas that were 10 feet that are now 3. Cost of dredging in 2012 was $65,000 in engineering costs and $1.3 million in dredging. We're anticipating that we're going to do this in 2023-24. Multiple aspects related to the cost, engineering costs for process and spoil area options, permitting, mobilization of the equipment, and then obviously the actual cost of the dredging itself. Next. So what we're anticipating coming up here is that the engineering is going to be $400,000 to $500,000, because it looks like the Army Corps of Engineers is not going to let anybody use a spoil area anymore. It's going to be a new concept. They've used it successfully in some other areas where basically what they try to do is use high flow velocity areas. So they're thinking that water going in and out of the Deweese Inlet at certain times, they can dredge and maintain a certain amount of material, and as the current reaches a certain speed, then they can release that material. there's potentially a little bit of a sideline benefit to this, that it's not pure sand, but it is sort of sandy, and it's going to end up a mile or a half a mile or maybe a little bit more offshore, but probably is going to reduce, if this is the option that gets used, it probably will help reduce at least a little bit some of the erosion. This is a big number, though. I mean, $65,000 a decade ago now, it's $400,000 to $500,000. We're hoping to share this with Toller's Cove, Waterway Island, Deweese, and the Isle of Palms community, and we think the dredging could be up to $2.5 million for the actual dredging next. So what do we hope to accomplish from this? Next. We're hoping to get some support from Isle of Palms. I know that Isle of Palms got $1.5 million from FEMA funds to help maintain this marina. And so we're not talking just about, next. We're not talking just about the commercial area and the restaurant area down here. The plug involves next, the whole thing. So I think it just behooves us to try to, as good neighbors, just cooperate and try to work on this together, both for our cost savings and just as kind of a matter of principle. Next. We're also trying to get some support from the resort. And unfortunately, and you know, the council, and I'm sure you all know this, they've not been just great partners as of late. And they own next, one more time. They own about 100 feet of frontage on that seawall there. And on that side, that's 2.2 lots. So we've been sending them bills for their share for maintenance of the marina, because we've tried to build up a reserve fund for the dredging as well as maintaining the seawall. And they refused to pay it. So we sent them a bill for their two shares, because we're building the seawall right now, and I don't want to talk about that much, except just to point out, we just said, it's $19,500, what you owe us for your two shares for there, and they, again, refused to pay it. So, next. So I got the idea, I talked to some of the Moore Creek Harbor Association people into agreeing, we had an attorney talk to the resort and say, we're not gonna restore the wall on your part then. If you don't want to be part of the Morgan Creek Harbor Association, you can just do it yourselves. It's going to cost $1,200 per foot. So they have 100 feet, probably $120,000, plus they'll have to get their own engineering, their own permits, etc. Now all of a sudden they want to be part of the Wild Dunes communities, or the Morgan Creek Harbor Association, but they've been very, very difficult and uncooperative to work with, even though they have a very scenic spot on there, and that wall is going to fail at some point, and the 16th tee will fall into the marina next. We've also gone to the Wild Dunes Community Association to talk to them next. And our pitch to them is, you know, they've been building up a reserve fund by taking a percentage of home sales and using that towards the beach renourishment fund, which they have pretty much already maxed out. And we know there's a little bit of an unknown about how much that's actually going to cost, but what we're talking about is taking a portion of the excess that they now accumulate of those home sales for homes that are affected by this marsh area, and putting that in towards this dredging fund. And you know, all of us on the backside of the island help with the beach renourishment, and we're not even asking people on the front to help. We're just saying the people that are affected by this, some of the money that we put into this fund should hopefully come back to us. Next. Almost done here. Next. So everybody's all jazzed up about the front of the island, the beach, and the importance of that. Next. The marina is kind of in the middle of the water. It's kind of between the waterway and the ocean and the marsh. Next. And so we think that the back part of the island is just as important as the front, but the key is the dredging of the marina. If the marina is dredged and stripped properly and we can get it deep enough, we'll get a good decade out of having a really healthy marsh area. And it's going to be expensive. And if everybody does it individually, all the engineering costs have to be done individually. The permitting has to be done individually. And so we're just here making a pitch that hopefully when you all get ready to do this, that we can have a conversation and keep us in the loop and do all this together. So I really appreciate you giving me a little bit of time to talk about this. I'm glad to take a few questions. I know you got a lot of other things on your agenda, but appreciate your time.
Just quickly, there's a quick answer. Can you speak to what causes the plug to occur? Why is sediment occurring there, and what could be preventative measure as opposed to a series of just maintenance issues of drainage?
Yeah, there isn't any preventive thing. Basically, what happens is just the breakdown of all of the plant life in the back that just turns into sludge, and some of it you see is the rack that's spread out everywhere, but a lot of that just disintegrates and it just becomes compost, basically. So that it's as simple as that, just dead marine life and both animal and plant life just becomes slush that fills it up.
Didn't used to do that until they dredged the marina back in the 70s and never did develop it, and then Wild Dunes came in and that wasn't even Wild Dunes.
Isle of Palms Beach and Raptor Club.
Sea pines before.
You refer to the Morgan Creek Association, which I'm assuming is homeowners on both sides, there's condos in there. Is the city part of that association because they own waterfront at the city commercial property? Are they part of that same association?
They're not part of the Morgan Creek Harbor Association. They're an independent group.
Gotcha.
So they stop and then we start. So just food for thought. I know this is a project that's probably a year and a half, maybe 2 years off, but I just hope that you all will keep the Morgan Creek Harbor Association in the loop, and I think we can do a lot of cost savings by working together, just because if each one of us does independently, we're all going to be paying the same engineering fee, we're all going to be paying the same permitting fee, we're all going to be fighting for some place to put the stuff. So anyway,
typically the city has done the whole process and joined the different associations involved, Louise Island, the city, and Morgan Creek, to oversee it, because it's easier for the city to get the permits, I think, than the individuals.
Usually.
Yeah, I would just add that the city has engaged ATM, Kirby Marshall specifically, to do the bathymetric surveying for, and I do think it's just the marina portion and going out to the intracoastal. And part of his work, and I believe we've already committed to this with ATM, that they would reach out to see who, to Sandy's point, who wanted to piggyback onto that agreement with the city in terms of permitting construction. It's been done several different ways over the years, but the city has always, we do basically carry the brunt of the permitting, and especially in the, right there at the marina proper. So I think some coordination is already contemplated. I never know to what level the city will participate or.
One of the rumors that I heard was that the timing wasn't going to work out, that you were going to have to do it at an earlier date than us. I've talked to Mike Loftus, Mike's talked to Mayor Pounds and a few other people, and that doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, this is not something that there's like a month or two that you can do it. So, anyway.
I would suggest you making contact with Kirby Marshall with ATM and just have that discussion and express your interest in coordinating any which way you can.
Just a sideline, I don't know if y'all know this, the president of ATM is probably the world's most famous marine engineer. He's inspected over 300 marinas all over the world, and the guy knows everything about this one and the one in Dubai that looks like a palm tree and everything in between. It's a very impressive company.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you all for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. When did we last dredge? The city dredged the front and the approaches. Louise wasn't ready to help, as I remember, and Morgan Creek wasn't at a point where they needed it at that time either. Is it 10 years ago?
Seems to me like it's been 5 years ago, but
probably has been more like, that's probably
more
like
4 to 5.
It's been 12 years.
We finished 12. In 2013. And you all had finished a little bit.
We had already finished, so more than 10 years.
Yeah, so you had finished almost a year before we had finished, and we finished in 2013.
Okay. Now, the Morgan Creek Board is also a touch base with DeWeese and Tollers to partner. So I don't know where Al Palms is in this communication. I haven't heard anything about Al Palms talking to this group.
So. Yeah, I would urge all of them to make contact with Kirby with ATM. He is the point of contact for the city, and they're under contract to begin that bathymetric survey to get, which is the front part of the permitting, so that we've basically started the permitting process. But I'm pretty sure our scope with ATM at this point is just the area just immediately adjacent to the marina.
Okay, because I know the board sent a letter out to Desiree to about what we're doing from the other MAR board. And the biggest problem that we've run into thus far, which is early on, is where you're going to put the crap. You know, no one wants it anymore.
Right.
So I think if everyone's facing it together, it'd be a lot better than individuals.
Sites you saw in the spoil area.
The spoil areas aren't, the one on the other side of Goat Island is not available anymore. There's no areas that are available anymore.
Well, I know, but one of them, yeah.
If you have a connection with it, maybe you'll get a lot of debris.
All right. We're ready to move on to resiliency?
We are.
So in your packet is an updated version of the comprehensive plan draft resiliency element. Matt and I met with Suzanne and Stephen, kind of went over the old version that you all had previously seen, talked about some modifications. Matt has made some of those changes. We've kind of gone back, and I think we have another round of comments from Stephen and Suzanne to be incorporated in, but we were at a point where we just wanted to share it with you and see if you all had comments, concerns, or get your input at this point before we went too much further. I have also made contact with the Corps of Engineers about the report that they did, and they have some acronyms for that report, but they have assigned a dollar amount, and Stephen's much better versed in this than I am, but I'm trying to get kind of a breakdown of what they think our vulnerabilities are in terms of resilience. And they've given us a canned answer, but we'd like to have them just come talk to us. I don't know that we've gotten to the right person yet, and it probably was a consultant, I'm guessing, so I don't know that there is a perfect person. So Suzanne, Stephen, anything to add or comments?
No, I think, you know, what we talked about and some of the figures and charts you added are good. I think they're improved, and I think they're much more Isle of Palms specific than talking about the region as a whole or what's going to happen in Charleston or North Charleston or Pleasant. So I think that's on the right track. I think in general, when you look through the Army Corps plan, you looked at their risk model, we didn't score very high on a lot of risk issues, and that's in some ways a good thing. You know, there wasn't a lot of cultural impact or natural resource impact, or since we do beach renourishment already, there wasn't a lot of erosion and sediment. They did calculate some numbers for potential facility and building damage, and they have a model to do that, and you guys played with that, and even when you run that, the numbers don't come out that high. So I think it kind of showed that, in spite of the fact that we're a little barrier island, there, in the big picture, we're not going to draw a lot of national or regional attention because we have a lot of risk associated with these issues, which is fine. but it doesn't mean it's not important to us. You know, $20 or $50 million worth of damage may not be much to the city of Charleston, but it's a lot to us. So I think that's what we have to take out of this, is what are the issues that we should be focusing on? And it mainly boils down to, flooding and structural damage and infrastructure damage, and then taking a step back from that, maybe not even in the comprehensive plan, but in really more of a specific resilience plan, saying, what are the plans? Those should already exist in many places. You know, Iowa Palms Water and Sewer Commission, Dominion, South Carolina DOT, Charleston Water, all these people should have contingency plans on what's going to happen in the event of whatever the issue is. So I think part of this is pulling that information together would be helpful in either in a separate document or seeing that those already exist. I don't think we need that in the comprehensive plan. I think what we've got here is about the right level of effort, showing here's what the issues are going to be and here's how we're going to address it. The only other thing that kind of jumped out at me was if you really look at what the damage that they keep coming up with, either due to a hurricane or sea level rise, or it really boils to flooding. You know, they're saying the island is prone to flooding. Gee, no surprise. And sea level rise exacerbates that. Hurricanes exacerbate that. So should we be looking at things to minimize that damage in the case of flooding? The one chart we put in here says, you know, over the next 20 years, we could see twice as much parts of the island flooding. Well, that's fine. Do our building codes help us prevent flooding damage? And I think we've done some things that maybe do and maybe don't. You know, if there are structures that are below flood elevation, are we allowing them to be improved and spend more money on them? Or should we be saying we should be minimizing the amount of money that's spent on structures that are below flood elevation and improving those structures? So I think those are the kind of things from a planning point of view we should be looking at. Are we on the right path to minimizing damage due to future flooding? Suzanne?
I know you spent some time with that. I'm not going to repeat what you just said, but I do agree that a more robust plan is needed. And where we're headed now in the contingency plan, the comprehensive plan, looks good.
Yeah, that was part of the challenge was to, you know, we have the existing comprehensive plan, which kind of roughly dedicates 2, 3, 4, 5 pages to each element within it with a series of recommendations. I think we wanted to be sure that we didn't kind of put 45 pages in one element. So we're trying to strike that balance of fitting into the current document well and at the right kind of level of detail. We've tried to do that. I think, I think that what we have now does a pretty good job of high level, but I think we know that a future plan would be necessary to get to the real nitty gritty of exactly what to do.
I do agree with Stephen though that pulling some of the other utilities and water treatment plant contingencies are together are important, because one of the things that will directly impact us is, you know, if anything happens to the water treatment facility. And being new and going in, I know they're planning bases are already laid out. But, sorry, what happens to them and how we address it? We could probably touch on that in this plan.
So we have a key issue in there, work with utility providers to improve resilience of infrastructure.
So we go down without water, what is the plan? You know, we go down without, you know, water treatment, what is our plan?
Well, it would also be kind of, I think, probably kind of nice even in here is even if we had like the projected recovery periods.
Right.
So whether we do something about it or not, knowing how long we're going to be without power, water, whatever, and then make a decision on whether that's it worth an investment to reduce that amount of time.
And that's usually analyzed all through these resiliency plans, looking, I call it a SWOT analysis, but it's strength, weakness, opportunity, threat. definitely on the right track.
Yes, so we're.
I had just a couple of comments reading through it.
Right.
On page 34, in the kind of middle of the red section, where it starts off traditionally the SACS future sea level rise. That sentence, I just had a hard time understanding what was. I don't know if y'all were going to reword it or look at that.
So that, okay. So I don't know if that, and it's my understanding of that sentence and that report that there's going to be an additional 2,000 acres. Is that right, Steve?
Well,
that's at risk and kind of, I guess when you do the inundation
right.
mapping, it's showing 2,000 acres.
Well, that was my comment.
I think it'd be said more simply than that sentence.
The way it read to me was there are 2,000 acres currently at high risk or medium high risk, and then additional 2,000 or half of the current acreage. So it just didn't come across the way it was.
Yeah, well, you're specific with 2,000 acres, and then you're inspecific with the other half.
Okay.
What other half?
Which I thought we were only about 4,500 acres total.
We are.
So
4,000 acres.
So that was saying.
Right, half the island is a medium to high risk in the future.
That's where I was trying to go. Is what are you trying to say?
I think the sentence could almost just say that. We don't have to get into the convoluted way of saying it backdoor. But their model predicts over 2,000 acres will be a medium to high risk of flooding in the future.
And along that note, I think the last paragraph I'm a little confused about. I don't know if it could be moved to issues and strategies. Or if it's just an informational.
The blue in 2022, that paragraph?
Yes, right above key issues. 135. That's what we're in the process of doing?
Question. Right. That's correct.
So that going under strategies, because since it's not completed,
I mean, that is, you think that's better in a strategy? That specifically is 4.2, sealing the back of the island. I think that's more appropriate as a, and I think our goals and strategy numbers need to. So that'd be a strategy 4.2.2?
I think it would look good as a strategy.
Okay.
I also had a comment on it was goal 4.1. That one just hit me. The goal of build dunes and restore beaches as opposed to, I guess, the protected dunes. I thought that, didn't see as our goal should be to build dunes.
Yeah.
It should be more to preserve or protect the dune system, maybe, which would include potentially building additional dune areas. But.
So, build and protect? Because we do occasionally build them.
Well, we already have an existing beach monitoring and re-nourishment program. What we really want to do is we want to continue monitoring the beach. That will then tell us what needs to happen. I don't think we need to say here what's going to happen, but we spend a lot of money with a lot of consultants telling us, testing the beach every year and telling us what's happening. So I think we want to encourage and continue a strong beach management program.
So is almost the strategy 4.11 the goal? Is to support beach renourishment projects?
But I don't, as identified from the beach management program, which we don't really talk about anywhere, we already have an existing beach management program.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, adding those words even to that would be fine.
So
So an acknowledgement, we have an ongoing beach management program.
Right.
And protect, build, restore, or nourish as
that's
described
identified.
by that
yep.
program.
Yep.
And that would be goal 4.1, correct?
Cool. Yes.
And 4.21, that's where the dredging ties in. Right now, there's no volume available in the creeks because it's all full of mud. Once the dredging occurs, that will open up a lot of water space for the backside of the island.
Well,
4.21 just talks about supporting the administering measures that protect marshes on the backside of the island. It's kind of vague.
I think, Stephen, you and I submit this more. This is not the most updated, is it?
Well,
it's missing some stuff.
We have comments.
Yeah.
I mean,
maybe this is an older.
It's got some weird stuff going on.
That's why I'm going back and forth.
That sentence, I'm trying to make sense of it, and I know what you're saying. We're missing a graph, too, because it had both those graphs on
right.
there.
Yeah.
So maybe if we can update that, and then we can take a look at it by email or in the. I mean, I hate to go through it if it's not.
Well, 4.2 now in the modified page 36 says seal.
Yes.
Our first goal was 4.2, to seal the backside of the island from tidal intrusion. That's where we started. And then we started to adjust, so I don't know where.
I think it just didn't print the corrections. It's the most updated version of it.
Okay.
Well, we'll continue to. If the group is happy for the four of us to continue to just kind of work on it, that was our goal. I think we knew the strategies and goals were still kind of
our work in progress. Cleaned up with all the edits in it and do one more.
Another pass in January.
Yeah, because it's hard with all the changes and edits and comments right now.
But the first several pages are about
yeah, it's getting very, and just so it didn't jump out at me, but this graph has a red line.
Yeah, I saw that. Otherwise, if I don't get rid of that, then
yeah,
there is a red
the
line.
The red line is actually deleting that, but
that's
it's showing
it. Why don't you just accept all the changes?
Yeah,
and start cleaning it.
So,
because it is getting hard to follow. The only other one we don't really expand on, but again, I know I mentioned it in my sidebar comments, I don't know if I actually changed the text, was the somewhere we talk about here about encouraging elevating structures or something like that. I think maybe we need to be more specific than that. Because in some ways we've done just the opposite. We've encouraged keeping low structures. And that's a much bigger picture. That's not just even us, but I mean, council must realize if you're going to let a structure stay there below flood elevation and allow it to be improved 50%, 50%, 50%, 5 times, that's not raising the house. So, I mean, right now that's what our rules
allow. That's correct.
Yeah. So we need to wrestle with that.
That's picking your poison.
Yeah.
I know.
We've worked hard to keep those.
I know, and I'm saying there's arguments both ways, but I think you can't say we want to encourage elevating houses, but then your codes don't encourage that.
I would point out a similar kind of head scratcher that we've been wrestling with, and you will recall the last subdivision we approved was Forest Trail, kind of 3 lots went to 5, and that cul-de-sac goes down to an elevation of I think it's 3 or 4 feet, but at a high tide that cul-de-sac goes well underwater. Our current codes only allow an owner to elevate their lot 1 foot above the road. So our codes require those brand new properties, brand new lots, to be down at like 4 feet above sea level. So we've actually brought that up, you know, with the Davis and Floyd group who is doing, they're looking at our development standards. You know, I know that the intention to keeping somebody from elevating their lot was concern over the neighbors and running the water towards their neighbor, but right now we might not have the correct balance in terms of ensuring that we have resilient neighborhood going forward if we're requiring them to build.
So we don't need necessarily have the answer here, but we probably should identify that there are, take a look at existing codes that
right.
that are not resilient friendly, so to speak, that need to be revisited in order looking at long-term resilience.
Right.
And we just mentioned too, there may be some others.
It's a good, I mean, to Ron's point, that both of those we kind of picked our poison, neither one is
yeah.
perfect. And
because we've had discussions about the flood insurance rates
yep.
and the flow chart of things you can get credit for, and it wasn't a whole lot of credit to
it was the 5-year tracking that we did away with, which is
right.
what Stephen's referencing, which allows somebody to do 49%, 49%, 49%. Used to track that over 5 years. So maybe we went, you know, maybe we just went too far on the side of.
But on the other side of that, I mean, that just takes in will and patience if you wanted to restore your non-compliant grade level house. But also 10 years ago, most of our conversations in the Planning Commission had to do with the size of all the new homes.
Yeah.
Because they're elevated. They could be a 2,500 square foot house, but you put it 9 feet in the air, it's going to feel a whole lot better. And then the sociological effect of living in a raised house. For those of you who still live at grade, God bless you. The rest of us don't know what our yard looks like anymore. Yeah. Mine. I don't want to see what my yard looks like. Because you quite literally psychologically separate. You're living in your raised house with your raised porch and your raised pool if you can afford it.
Well, I'm on the ridge along Cameron Boulevard.
You know, there you go. That's right. So I think just identifying that we should be looking at
yep.
codes and how they affect resilience. Because I agree, there's arguments on both sides.
And there's flood resistant construction that doesn't mean you have to be on stilts.
Correct.
Yeah, so I would hope, and I'm sure.
No, perfect example.
I'm sure the facility on Forest Trails, I think they call it, sewer
right.
building, is flood resistant, even though there's no area for elevation for the floodwaters to flow underneath. Things that concrete shit house.
Yeah.
There's a few houses like that out here, too.
Yeah.
Right. So, I think of if.
You got something to hold that?
Yeah, I think that we're understanding. We'll continue to work, clean it up, bring another iteration at your January meeting.
Okay.
And I think that's perfect.
Cool.
You have any new business? Any other miscellaneous business?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion to second. All in favor?
Discussion.
Off record 5:32.